From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The death toll from that Syrian gas attack continues to rise. It's now at least 72, one of the deadliest incidents in the six-year-old Syrian civil war. And, of course, a horrific use of chemical weapons that was supposed to be removed under an Obama-era deal. The UN Security Council is considering a resolution condemning the use of chemical weapons in Syria. Today, U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley said if the UN isn't going to act, we, the U.S., may. And in an interesting side note, while this goes on, one of the president's top security advisors, Steve Bannon, has been removed from the National Security Council. We'll keep an eye on that as we bring in Greg Myrie, NPR national security correspondent in Washington. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Robin.
So Assad's regime says that deadly gas was actually released when a Syrian airstrike hit a rebel arsenal. What do we know about those claims?
Well, we're still in the investigative stage, but we have a history here, and the Syrian regime has always denied using chemical weapons and often blamed the rebels. But the evidence, the limited evidence that we have so far, suggests this came from an airstrike by the Syrian government on Tuesday morning.
Yeah, well, and doctors have said that the injuries would not be, you know, the same if it were from something blowing up on the ground. But meanwhile, remind us why there would be chemical weapons in Syria. They were supposed to be removed and destroyed in that multilateral deal struck with the UN and Russia during the Obama administration after a gas attack in 2013. Russia was supposed to be shipping the weapons away from Syria.
That's right. And Syria declared the weapons. They were taken out. However, there was always doubt, and even some doubts from within the Obama administration, did Syria remove all its chemical weapons, number one. Number two, it has the technology to make them, so it could make more after it had released its stockpile. So that's certainly been the issue for the last 3 or 4 years. We haven't seen a chemical weapons attack on this scale since then. What we have seen are chlorine attacks, considered sort of a poor man's chemical weapon because it has multiple uses and it's not nearly as deadly as some of these other agents, the sarin gas attack back in 2013 that you were referring to. So this would suggest that this is the most serious attack we've seen in the last 4 years.
Yeah. Well, and it's only added to the blame game. We have a White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer saying this chemical attack was a consequence of the weakness of the Obama administration. We remember President Obama drew a line in the sand in 2012, but when Syria crossed it, he did not do something militarily. He worked on that chemical weapons deal. But his supporters say the U.S. didn't have the stomach for a military attack in 2012, and it didn't seem as if Donald Trump did either.
Well, you know, I hate to use the phrase have the stomach for. I guess the point is what would be achieved by that? And the U.S., the Obama administration, and the Trump administration have focused very much on attacking ISIS. They consider that the greatest threat to the United States. And Obama started bombing ISIS in 2014. Trump has certainly emphasized that. The Obama administration did call for the removal of Assad. They say he should step down, but didn't do anything to attack him. Now we're going to see what the Trump administration might do. But again, they've already been giving signals, and again yesterday, that removing Assad is not their top priority.
Yeah, and we just should add that back then, a then civilian Donald Trump sent out tweets urging President Obama not to strike the Assad regime, to hold his powder, I think was the phrase that he used in different tweets. But what about the messages coming now from President Trump's administration? Some are saying that it's given Assad free rein. If the president is saying, you know, we are not looking to remove, if President Trump is saying we're not looking to remove President Assad.
I think this would be the latest of several things that are making President Assad feel pretty comfortable, that the Trump administration is saying removing him is not a priority. Go back a couple months to when the Assad regime captured Aleppo, the last major city it didn't control. The United States campaign against ISIS has gained momentum, and ISIS is on the defensive. You put all these things together, and Assad is feeling pretty comfortable these days and seems to have no real reason to negotiate. He's feeling pretty strong and perhaps as strong and as confident at any time in the last 6 years of the war.
Well, we heard Ambassador Haley at the UN say if the UN isn't going to act, we, the U.S., may. Doing what? Is there a sense of what that would be?
What's been discussed during the Obama administration and perhaps is still being discussed now, would be something like bombing the Assad Air Force, taking out his planes, his runways, that sort of thing. We're not hearing that in a way that suggests it's a serious option at the moment. That's the kind of thing that's been discussed, but it hasn't happened. That would create all sorts of additional complications in the war. The U.S. has been talking with the Russians about how to fight ISIS and things like that. So you would add a whole other layer of complications if you did start going after the Assad regime.
Because, of course, Russia backs the Assad regime.
Correct.
Greg Myrie, NPR's national security correspondent. Thanks as always.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, now to the fight over Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley spent all night and a good part of the morning on the Senate floor speaking out against Gorsuch. Merkley's 15-hour speech was more for show than anything else. There is practically no chance that anything the Democrats do now will stop or even delay Gorsuch's confirmation. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already set the vote for tomorrow, and he has enough senators behind him willing to trigger the so-called nuclear option and change the Senate rules to confirm Gorsuch with a simple majority, or 51 votes. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg is with us now. Hi, Nina.
Hi there.
And leaving aside the fact that I cannot stand that term nuclear option when we have actual nuclear situations in parts of the world, but that's what they call it, so that's what we'll call it. And what is the calculus for the Democrats here? Why have they decided it's worth it for them to go ahead with this and force the Republicans to change the rules so that the Supreme Court nominees will only require 51 votes?
Well, I'm not sure that it's much of a strategic calculus. It's a political calculus. They're getting so much pressure from their own left flank to do something. And this is the something that they can do right now, is to at least show they have 60 votes. And there are, you know, members of the political left who have threatened to primary Democrats who don't vote against Gorsuch and don't toe the line on this. It's sort of you're seeing the left of the Democratic Party do what the right has been doing to the Republicans for a while.
Is there any chance that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans balk at the last minute and decide not to invoke the nuclear option?
Look, I know this show is based in Boston, so Red Sox fans know you never say never, but I think this game is pretty much over.
Okay. Well, you've watched a lot of confirmation processes for the Supreme Court, some of them highly contentious. Does it surprise you that it's Gorsuch's nomination that has led to this, to the nuclear option?
Yes and no. You know, he's not the kind of incendiary nominee, highly controversial nominee that you might think would cause this. On the other hand, he was very evasive during the confirmation hearings. I think that's a fair rap. I don't think the Democrats, on the other hand, were able to portray him as some sort of wacko, crazy conservative. So, but then you have to add in the fact that the Republicans, for almost a year, wouldn't even hold a hearing for Obama nominee Merrick Garland, and that really was unprecedented, and it just infuriated the Democrats as it just beyond belief. So it doesn't surprise me in that sense.
Do you think that if the Democrats, though, had held the Senate last year when President Obama nominated Merrick Garland, that they would have done what Republicans are doing now and changed the rules to get Garland through with a simple majority?
Well, they might have. There are, you know, more senior members who hate that idea, but they might well have done that if there was a filibuster. And the Republicans had used the filibuster in unprecedented ways to block lower court judges before, which is why the Democrats abandoned the filibuster for lower court judges and executive nominees. There were literally over 100 of the two combined who were filibustered. And so I think they probably would have done the same thing if push came to shove.
So if, as expected, Mitch McConnell does go with the nuclear option, do you see any scenario in the future where the Senate decides to change the rules back and get back to that 60 vote?
Not realistically. Do you know, by the way, where this maneuver first came from, the nuclear option, except it was called something else back then? It was 1957. Richard Nixon, then vice president, dreamed it up to try to get around what was an anticipated civil rights filibuster from Dixiecrats. All it took was the threat of what was then called the constitutional option. And they the the Southern Democrats abandoned their plans. And then it was revived. The idea of it was really revived during the George W. Bush administration when Dick Cheney started talking about the nuclear option.
Hmm. Interesting. So what are the consequences of it, Nina? Does it mean that from now on, if you only need 51 votes to get a Supreme Court nominee confirmed, that the nominees themselves are going to be more to the right or more to the left?
Well, Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, said at the Judiciary Committee vote this week, he said, you know, this struck a lot of the people who'd been in the Senate in a way that makes them sad because they can see what the future is, they think, that there will be more extreme nominees on both sides, as Graham put it, more ideologically extreme nominees. Every Senate contest will turn into a fight over the Supreme Court. And you've already seen evidence of that with millions and millions of dollars being spent by mainly the right, but also the left over the Gorsuch nomination.
That's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Chinese President Xi Jinping arrives in Florida tomorrow for a two-day meeting with President Trump. And in anticipation of that visit, we've been talking about the rise of China as a global power with Gideon Rockman. He's chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. His new book is called Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline, From Obama to Trump and Beyond. Let's continue our conversation. You know, as you look around the world in this book and you focus on different regions of the world, you notice that all these countries from China to India to Russia to Japan to the Philippines and Turkey and Hungary, they all are very nationalistic right now and they all want this to be their country's moment. But it can't be every country's moment.
No, and I think it's one of the trends in world politics that does worry me. There is a resurgence of nationalism, which is slightly surprising in a way because, you know, 10 years ago, it was the heyday of globalization, the world is flat, all of that, and everyone was saying nations are going to become less and less relevant in a borderless world. And politically, that just doesn't seem to be happening. So that you have resurgent nationalism in the East, in the West, in other words, in Asia and the West. You also have it in democracies and non-democracies. So you have Trump saying, make America great again. But you have Xi Jinping in China talking about the great rejuvenation of the Chinese people. Hmm. What is Vladimir Putin about? Well, make Russia great again.
Right.
He's also doing that. I mean, in Britain, our decision taken to leave the EU is a form of nationalism. We're saying we don't like this supranational EU organization. We want to go back to being Great Britain. Turkey, a very important country, you know, right at the hinge of the Middle East, also a NATO member.
Is it a coincidence that it's all happening right now, though, that all these countries are having this wave of nationalism at the same time?
I don't think it is. Politics goes in fashions. I think there is a degree of emulation happening. So I think that it's quite interesting, the cult of Vladimir Putin around the world. You know, he's not particularly popular in the UK or the US, but among certain forms of nationalist leaders, you know, there are lots of books about Putin sell very well in China because he's seen as a guy who stuck it to the US, to be honest. The far right in Europe are very keen on Putin. Erdogan in Turkey has built up a special relationship with him. And actually, you know, when I met Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel for this book, he also made the point that he got on pretty well with Putin. So there is a kind of admiration thing going on because he's seen as reviving this model of strongman leadership, and particularly when Obama was around, the contrast between the slight swagger of Putin and the more deliberative style of Obama, and indeed of Angela Merkel in Germany, was very striking. But I wonder whether also the nationalism revival has other things to it. It might be a reaction against globalization, a reaction to big migratory flows, so build the wall by Trump to keep the Mexicans out, build the wall in Hungary to keep the Syrians out. But it's not something that I think people would have predicted 10 years ago. But it's very hard to deny it's happening now.
I think a lot of Americans, though, when they look at the changing dynamics in the world, would say, well, why would any other country want to follow the lead of an authoritarian regime like in China or even, you could say, Russia, instead of the United States? When push comes to shove, they're going to want the country with freedom of the press and freedom of speech and all these other freedoms rather than be led by an authoritarian.
Yeah, you would think so, and maybe that will be the case, and in the long run. But I think that there is certainly in China. Put it this way: in 1989, which was not just the year of the fall of the Berlin Wall, it was also the year of the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing, when people like me thought, okay, look, there's no way the Chinese Communist Party can last, because you would have had a demand for freedoms and so on. But actually, although there is repression in China, no doubt about it, there is also, I think, a kind of legitimacy created by very powerful economic growth and increasingly by a very deliberately cultivated nationalism, saying, that China's back, China's standing up to the West, all of that. Now, does that sell around the world? I think to an extent, because the idea that the era in which the whole world was basically shaped first by the Europeans and then by the US is coming to a close, that's quite a powerful idea, say, not just in China, but say in Turkey, where you kind of have Erdogan pushing a nationalist sentiment, saying, that Turks can stand up. They no longer need to be pushed around by the West. They no longer need to aspire just to be like the US or Europe. They can have their own cultural models. Now, not everybody in those societies accepts that at all, but there's no doubt in my mind there's a constituency for it.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Gideon Rockman, who is chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. His new book is Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline, from Obama to Trump and Beyond. And Gideon Rockman, we have to talk about India, because India is the second most populous country after China. But China, as you point out in this book, is clearly very worried about India. They have created basically a ring of port cities from China all the way down to Africa to make sure that they've got the routes that they need to get the resources that they need, getting around India. And then this is something I didn't realize, that the Chinese are helping out Pakistan as much as possible in order to give India some trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what the Indians think. And I think they're increasingly worried by it, because you said that the Chinese are worried by the Indians, and they are a bit. But I think the Indians are even more worried about the Chinese, because they're that much further behind. And they, as they've grown, have come to aspire, naturally enough, to be a much bigger global player. But they feel that China is both a direct and an indirect threat to them. A direct threat because there is a territorial dispute between China and India. There were two countries fought a war in 1962, and they're a large chunk of India that China actually claims. And occasionally, Chinese troops cross the border and go backwards and forwards on Chinese passports. And the Indians feel that the Chinese are trying to contain them partly by supporting their old adversary, Pakistan, which is a frightening thing, because India and Pakistan have fought three wars. They're both nuclear powers. It's pretty certain that the Pakistani nuclear program got some aid from China. And actually, China has a certain vulnerability, because a lot of its oil comes from the Middle East. It has to come a long way around. Chinese have basically sponsored the building of a very large port in Pakistan, which gives them a much shorter route to get the oil from the Gulf to this Pakistani port, and then they can move it across land to China. So there's big infrastructure routes being built right across Pakistan to China. And then there's the other question, whether, as you remark, China's also building up other alliances. It's got very close to Sri Lanka, which is the island nation at the bottom of India. It's built ports there. It's built ports in Burma. So if you kind of took a geostrategic look at the map, you would think, if you were Indian, there's almost what they call a string of pearls being built around us that they might one day tighten around our neck.
Well, it reminds you, even in the 21st century, that shipping is still really important to power.
I know. It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah, it feels very 19th century, doesn't it, that people should still be worrying about sea routes and so on. But it does matter, because oil, to be blunt, I mean, America's slightly alleviated its problem because of the shale gas thing. So America's less dependent on Saudi oil than it used to be. China, however, is very dependent on oil from both Saudi Arabia and Iran. And one of the paradoxes of world affairs now is that the Straits of Hormuz, through which all this oil passes, are kept open by the U.S. Navy. And both sides think that's a bit peculiar. The Americans are thinking, why are we basically providing China's security for it? And the answer to that, of course, as I spoke to Americans about this, and they thought, well, we have thought maybe we could pull out, but then if how would we feel if actually the Chinese Navy was patrolling the Persian Gulf? And I think the Chinese, on the one hand, think it's great that they don't have to have this commitment in the Gulf, which comes with all sorts of complications to it. On the other hand, it makes them feel a bit vulnerable because they think, well, actually, the American Navy is all along the route that our oil comes through. It's in the Gulf where the oil starts coming through, but then it's also by the Malacca Straits where it has to continue, which is this very narrow strait of water, the busiest waterways in the world between Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And again, the U.S. Navy is based in Singapore, or rather operates out of Singapore. So the Chinese have what they call a Malacca Strait dilemma. They think, look, if there was ever a conflict, we could be in real trouble there.
So what would your one piece of advice to the Trump administration be to try to stop the Easternization of the world?
I would say you can't stop it. You're not going to be able to go back to the era in which America dominated both the global economy and dominated the global political scene. But that needn't be a disaster if you can, through a kind of judicious mix of policies, accept the inevitability of the rise of China, but then try to manage it so that you set some rules both for the global economy and you keep your alliances firm in Asia, but not so firm that you actually slide into a confrontation with China. Now, that's not an easy balance to strike,
right,
but it is the one that I think successive administrations in different ways have ended up with. It's sort of what the Bush administration was doing. It's what the Obama administration was doing. And I think any administration, even one whose rhetoric is quite as radical as that of Donald Trump's, when they look at the set of choices facing America, will probably end up, if they're sensible, with something similar, which tries to emphasize cooperation where you can, but set some guidelines and some lines for China on the use of force and on how it treats its neighbors. It's a fine balance to strike, but I don't think it's impossible.
That's Gideon Rachman, a chief foreign affairs commentator for the Financial Times. His new book is called Easternization, Asia's Rise and America's Decline from Obama to Trump and Beyond. Fascinating. Gideon, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
With reports that lawmakers are back working on a new health care plan, chiropractors and naturopaths have been lobbying for their services to treat pain management, especially as the opioid epidemic rages and as the Trump administration considers flexible spending accounts in which people could use the money to pay for services that insurance companies don't yet approve of. States may be getting on board. Last year, Oregon allowed the state Medicaid program to cover spinal adjustments for lower back pain. Vermont, Virginia, Nevada could follow. But some traditional physicians are wary. Megan Thielking reports for STAT, our partners in health and medicine coverage. And Megan, those offering alternative care, what are they offering?
So naturopaths and chiropractors are offering a whole slew of different alternative pain treatments. The more common ones that you're probably familiar with are acupuncture and massage therapy, but they're also offering herbal supplements and castor oil patches to sort of curb pain without having to use a prescription painkiller.
Yeah, well, there are real concerns about this, as you know. There are some physicians who worry that some natural medications might interact negatively with traditional ones, let's say for cancer treatments. When it comes to chiropractic, we had the story just a little while ago of the model, Katie May, who died after a neck manipulation. Now, it was thought that maybe she shouldn't have gone in so soon after injuring herself, that it was a cautionary tale about that as opposed to chiropractic. But there are doctors who are concerned that this is not science-based.
Yeah, one of the biggest concerns among those in mainstream medicine is that there's very little rigorous scientific research to back up these treatments. Naturopaths and chiropractors will argue back that they're relatively low risk and relatively low cost. And it's true that they are relatively low risk, but there are still risks involved with all of these treatments. As you mentioned, doctors are also worried about the potential risk of either medications interacting with these herbal supplements or of a naturopath convincing a patient to potentially forgo conventional medical care like chemotherapy.
Well, what are the lobbyists saying about why what they do would be more beneficial than what's being done now?
So the lobbyists say that there's a real desperate need for alternative treatments for pain other than opioids, just because of how bad the opioid epidemic has gotten. So what they're really lobbying for in particular is to expand their reach to veterans. So both chiropractors and naturopaths are lobbying Congress to push the Veterans Affairs health system to actually hire more alternative providers to give patients in pain something to go to other than painkillers.
I'm imagining another thing that is being brought up is that while, as we've seen with the opioid crisis, it's much simpler to give someone a pill for pain, alternative medicine isn't that simple. It's different for everybody. People behind alternative medicine say that's a good thing.
Right. Naturopathic providers say they have a place to offer these patients who haven't found relief in another way a whole slew of other options. And they really have more time to spend with a patient and try out new things than a traditional medical doctor might.
What's your sense? I mean, where's this going?
I don't think we know yet. I think some patients say they have found pain relief from some of these alternative treatments. And I think some doctors are starting to embrace the idea, but with a lot of caution still, kind of feeling out how these alternative treatments might be used in tandem with more conventional medical care.
Yeah. And of course, we should say that many traditional doctors are already recommending that their patients try alternative medication and chiropractic in addition to what that traditional doctor is doing. That's already happening, but we'll see where this goes. Megan Thielking at STAT, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
It's time now for the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Daryl Brogdon hosts the Retro Cocktail Hour, produced at Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence, where he's also the program director. Daryl, welcome back.
Aloha, Jeremy.
Aloha. And you've got some new music for us, and let's get right to it. Speaking of aloha, Swing Time in Honolulu is what this is called. It's by Alika Lyman. Now, this musician is the nephew of a famous exotica artist from the 1950s. First of all, before we get into Swing Time in Honolulu, just remind us where this style of music comes from.
Well, this is what we call exotica music, which is kind of a hybrid of Polynesian, Afro-Cuban, stirred in with a little American jazz and Hollywood movies. It's kind of melting pot music, I suppose. It's not real Polynesian or Afro-Cuban music. It just draws on elements of all those styles.
And tell us about this one in particular.
Well, Alika Lyman, as you said, is the nephew of Arthur Lyman, who was one of the legends of exotica music in the 1950s and early 60s. In fact, this comes from an album called Lays of Jazz, Volume 2. In the late 50s, Arthur Lyman did a very popular album called Lays of Jazz, and this is kind of an unofficial sequel. I always felt that Arthur Lyman, of all the exotica artists of the 50s, had the most jazz feeling. It was more of a small jazz group to me, and Alika Lyman really continues that tradition. He's a very talented guitar player, and this album just has a really light and airy flavor, and that tune, Swing Time in Honolulu, is actually by Duke Ellington. Probably not one of his better-known tunes, but it's still just a really fun album.
All right, well, let's get to the next one. This is the Swedish group Ixtawela. This is Curitiba Train. ¶¶ Got some birds in the background there.
It is. This is a very classic Exotica sound. Ixtawele is a group from Sweden. Of course, a hot spot of tropical Exotica music. But
why is that? Why is that? I mean, it's so cold in Sweden.
Oh, it's not. In fact, this is probably the only tiki band going in Sweden right now. Uh-huh. But they play very much in the classic Exotica style, very similar to the Alika Lyman group we just heard, although they've added a piano and some bird calls and a little more percussion. And unlike a lot of Exotica bands today, what they're doing is creating new music instead of playing the old standards. They're actually creating new tunes on their new CD, which is Call of the Islands.
And if you go to their website, they have a video of a live performance, and you see these four guys that look pretty young, maybe early 30s. Is that who's filling out the Exotica world today?
That's right. And these guys are, I think at least some of them are rockabilly musicians who have kind of an Exotica thing going on too. So I've seen them in person, in concert, and they're really a wonderful band. They're consummate musicians, and they really have a tremendous feeling for that classic Exotica vibe.
Well, let's go from Sweden to Japan now. You wanted us to hear the artist Jazztronic. This is Adventures in Paradise. Now, this is where the Hollywood movie part of it is really clear. I mean, I could totally see that in the background of a movie with, like, people on horseback riding out through the desert on their way somewhere.
Well, it's really, really interesting you say that, because this tune is Adventures in Paradise, which was the theme from a late 50s TV series, and it was composed by Lionel Newman, Randy Newman's uncle, and a famous film composer, film and TV composer. And Jazztronic is actually it's a group led by Ryota Nozaki, who is a Tokyo-based DJ and pianist. And they do a lot of different things, a lot of different types of music on their various albums, jazz, house music, even a little hip-hop. But on this album, Aloha Exotica, they've, again, reimagined the classic Exotica sound of the 1950s. It's still respectful of that genre, but you can clearly hear this kind of a contemporary flavor to what they're doing.
And that the phrase Aloha Exotica, that is the second time that we've talked about Aloha in this DJ session. It seems like a lot of connections to Hawaii.
Well, that's really the foundation of what we know as Exotica music. From the 1950s with Martin Denny and Arthur Lyman and Les Baxter, artists like that, who were playing music that really was kind of a siren song for a whole generation of people, particularly ex-servicemen who were stationed in the South Pacific and became introduced to Polynesian culture, and hence the boom in this music in the post-war years with tiki bars on every corner and Polynesian-themed restaurants, so there was music to go with that.
All right, well, you have one more for us. This is the Australian artist Christopher De Groot. It's called Holiday Road Carnage. This one is very different, kind of creepy.
Yeah, this is what's playing at the tiki bar at Twin Peaks. This is David Lynch Exotica. Christopher De Groot is an Australian, a musician, a flutist, a keyboardist, a guitarist. He's actually scored some films. And he's together here with musicians from a tiki band called Slide Night. And this is some crazy music on this. It really runs the gamut. I mean, there's some 60s exotica flavor there, too. But there's some tunes that are like sci-fi movie soundtracks, a little John Zorn, and certainly a little bit of David Lynch-esque flavor to a lot of their tunes.
Hmm. Now, you've brought us exotica music here from a number of different countries. Is exotica music a global phenomenon at this point?
Most definitely. You know, in the 90s, vinyl diggers kind of rediscovered this music from the 1950s and 60s. And it wasn't long before record companies were reissuing some of the classic recordings. And soon after that, bands began to form. I mean, there are a number of tiki bands around the world. There's, you know, the Waitiki Seven. We listened to Ixtahuela today. Tiki Joe's Ocean is another tremendous band. The Stolen Idols in Florida. So they're really all over the world.
That's Daryl Brogdon, who hosts the Retro Cocktail Hour, produced at Kansas Public Radio in Lawrence. Daryl, thanks once again for joining us.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thank you.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. Just go to Spotify and search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
In President Trump's first months in office, he's taken aim at longstanding environmental policies on air and water pollution. Many Americans are protesting, but many Trump voters are cheering, especially in rural pockets of the country. Leslie McClurg of Here Now contributor KQED visited ranchers in Tehama County, a few hours north of San Francisco, and found this story.
Like most ranchers I talked to, Wally Roney wouldn't live anywhere but at the dead end of a road.
Right here is where the pavement ends and the west begins.
Roney swings open a rusted cattle guard dripping from a recent rainstorm.
Yeah, you're looking at Aberdeen Angus steer calves.
The cows lift their heads from grazing on clover. The setting sun reflects off their black, shiny coats. Roney grazes cattle on private and federal land. He's the sixth generation of his family to ranch here. When I ask him how many cows he has...
That's something you don't ask a cattleman.
Oh, really?
We never have enough when it comes time to pay our bills, and we always have too many when it comes time to feed them.
We hop in a huge silver pickup for a tour of Roney's ranch. We bump along a potholed road beneath giant oak trees. He pulls over at a creek where his cattle often drink. Although Hillary Clinton won California in a landslide, here in Tehama County, it was Trump who swept 65% of the vote. And Roney cheered back in February when President Trump shelved a law that would have expanded the Clean Water Act.
He said he was going to do it, and by golly, he did it.
Roney thought the law might limit where his thirsty cows could drink. He voted for Trump because the candidate is a businessman.
He hasn't made a living or tried to make a living being a politician. He's been in the trenches. You know, I understand that world.
Roney was relieved when Trump scrapped the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement in his first week of office. He worried that cheaper beef from Mexico would have driven down his profit margins.
TPP would have killed us.
Roney hopes Trump will build on these moves by rolling back environmental regulations. He's especially hopeful Trump will prevent California exemptions. The state standards are often stricter than federal regulations, and Roney is sick of it. Although he does believe in some rules, as long as they don't apply to him. For example, he supports the mining regulations on a gravel quarry on his property.
To protect that ground, we need to have certain regulations to keep them from destroying it.
He points out the window to the rim of mountains bordering his property.
On that skyline is probably some of the biggest pot gardens in California. Yeah, we need regulations. They hate me.
But he argues ranchers are different than pot growers. He and other ranchers don't need environmental rules to keep them in check. Just down the road, another sixth-generation rancher named Daryl Wood agrees.
As ranchers, you know, we're stewards of these landscapes.
We jump in an ATV to check on his herd. His dogs run alongside. His cows are certified organic.
It's called Panorama grass-fed beef.
No one in Wood's family has ever used chemicals on the rolling grasslands. He says he's motivated to farm organically because his beef sells for 25% more at market, but also because it feels right.
The land is what gives life to everything. So you got to love the land. We love the cattle. We love the dogs, our horses.
Wood is a lifelong conservative who believes in market forces rather than rules to protect the landscape from things like overgrazing.
So my theory on this is that, okay, the more regulations you have on something is not good. So let's create the incentive that makes them change their management practices.
Wood hopes Trump's administration will listen to ideas from people like him to create more incentive-based policies rather than more regulations.
Not just a group of people in Washington, D.C., sitting around a table and deciding what's best for me on my land. I want to be at that table.
A lot of people I talked to in Tehama County felt similarly, that the environmental conversation hasn't included their voices. Billy Roney says it best. She's the wife of rancher Wally Roney.
Is there anybody anywhere who I feel like-minded with who might be a little less radical? I've just felt disenfranchised for a long, long time.
Roney says she empathizes with people who are scared right now by what they're hearing from President Trump. She felt like that about Democratic plans to tighten gun control, expand immigration, and rewrite health care laws.
We had fears, too. All those visceral fears you're watching with people, that would be me in the fetal position watching some of the things that happened under the Obama administration.
Now, Billy Roney says listening to Trump is a welcome relief after 8 years where she felt like her way of life was not only ignored, but despised by the other side.
The Progressive Party looks at people like us as though we're the devil. It makes it really hard to find common ground.
Like many others in Tehama County, she says the only way to bridge the divide in California and the nation is for everyone to be at the table. For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg.
All points of view. Yours is welcome as well at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.